The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, good afternoon. Welcome to Capital Thinking. We've got a great show today. We're going to talk a little bit about what's happening in the United States Senate on credit card legislation. Then we're going to talk about the state of play for the Supreme Court nomination that President Barack Obama is facing. And we're going to end with an interview with the ambassador from Sri Lanka, talking a little bit about the threats from terror that they face in that nation and what they have going on here in Washington, D.C., and with the United Nations and the European Union to address that issue. But we start out with a country that is collectively maxed out its credit cards, and Congress is looking to deal with that. Our guest in this segment is our friend and frequent contributor to the show, Todd Cranford, public policy attorney at Patton Boggs and an expert on the world of financial services legislation. Todd, welcome back to the show. How are you doing today?
Yeah, good afternoon, Kevin. Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Todd is actually, I think, calling us from the Hill, where we could listen to him network just moments ago as he was waiting to come on the show. Todd, we know the Senate has got big plans this week on credit card legislation. Tell us a little bit about what's going on there today. What are the big battles taking place over that bill?
Kevin, as we've talked about previously on the show, the current Congress and the new administration have made consumer protection, investor protection, and reform major issues and battle cries. The House passed a couple of weeks ago a credit card holders bill of rights, which includes a number of provisions that, you know, clearly don't outlaw credit cards, but try to address a lot of perceived bad practices by credit card companies, how they bill, when they bill, and who they actually solicit cards, or who they actually solicit to use cards. That legislation passed overwhelmingly in the House and then was brought up in the Senate. Senator Dodd had introduced a bill, S-414, that had many similar provisions, and then he used that as a vehicle, as a manager's amendment, to take up the House version of the bill that passed last week. And that's the bill, the legislation that you referred to a moment ago, that's being debated as we speak on the Senate floor.
And Todd, what's the timeline? I've heard the president has set some timeline that he wants to get this done by. How quick are we moving here?
Well, that's going to be tricky. The president has asked for legislation to be on his desk before they break for the Memorial Day recess next Thursday. That is possible, but it is starting to look less likely just because of some Senate maneuverings that have gone on in the past couple of days. Specifically, an amendment was offered by Senator Colburn from Oklahoma to the credit card legislation regarding Second Amendment gun rights. And the many people may be wondering what Second Amendment gun rights have to do with credit card legislation, and the answer would be absolutely nothing.
Credit card bill, you know that I would take a gun to anybody trying to collect that right now.
Yeah, and there probably are many Americans right now that would like to take a gun to their credit card companies and thus this legislation. But the Senate procedure permits senators to attach amendments of any kind to any bill. They don't have the same type of what are referred to as germane issues that the House of Representatives has with any amendments that may be attached to a bill. So therefore, a senator can get up and offer an amendment on any subject to literally any piece of legislation. Still trying to figure out the real impact that that amendment may have to the legislation. It's very unlikely that the bill as a whole will be voted up or down with that amendment. I suspect that there will be secondary amendments offered to that amendment, to get it out of the bill in order to get it passed. Because of the timing, in order to get it to the president by the end of next week, it will have to be voted on by the Senate by tomorrow, or actually today, because they're not in session tomorrow, and get to the White House next week after a conference committee with the House to iron out the differences in the two bills. So that's the timing now. Depending upon what happens in the next several hours, we'll determine whether or not that bill can get to the president by the end of next week.
Now, I know, Todd, if I'm not mistaken, the president had credit card company executives down to the White House for a visit to the proverbial woodshed a couple weeks ago to sort of push the bill. You know, what's their viewpoint on this bill? What are the big issues that they're trying to iron out with the Senate to perhaps impact what this will do to them?
Right. Yeah, the president did have a meeting with the executives of the top 15 credit card issuing companies, the independents and the large banks. And they are trying, the banks and the management are literally trying to minimize the regulatory scheme so that they will continue to be able to make money. There is a concern that too much regulation right now will limit the amount of money that they can make. So it is their vested business interest that's at stake here, and they just want to be able to make money, particularly in the areas of fees and interest that are charged. How much can be charged? There haven't been any rate cap amendments or provisions in these particular bills. Those are very controversial, but there have been a number of amendments and provisions that clarify what the billing cycles are, when interest can be charged, and on what fee and on what money they can be charged. For example, pre-existing balances versus new balances, they would be prohibited from charging interest on the fees that they charge and only the balances incurred by the customers. Right now, it's my understanding that they are trying to work through in the Senate some of those issues to water them down because the Senate version was a little stronger than the House version that passed. There's also some conjecture that the Coburn Amendment may have been a function of industry resistance and hoping to be able to derail the legislation for a little while longer in order to be able to get some of these provisions. I'm sorry, what?
They would take the bill down and blame another interest group, huh?
Correct.
Interesting.
Or at least slow it down, because I think there's little chance that legislation will not pass. It's just a question of when.
Let me ask you a couple questions.
There's a great appetite on both sides of the Capitol and in the White House to get some credit card reforms through.
Todd, there are a couple of other interesting twists that I wanted to ask you about. One, there seems to be a big battle over these so-called interchange fees. What can you tell us about that?
Right. Well, Senator Durbin on the Senate side has introduced an amendment that would essentially limit the fees that the credit card companies can charge the merchants who accept credit cards. And, of course, the industry is very opposed to that, and it's a very sticky issue, one which Senator Dodd has publicly stated he does not want to address now. He believes that it is an important question that needs to be studied, which his legislation calls for a study on the interchange fees. But he has publicly said that he is opposed to including that in the current legislation, again, because it is very divisive, very controversial, and would likely bog down the bill, which he badly wants to get past. He and Senator Shelby spent much of the last week trying to negotiate and hammer out their differences, Senator Shelby being the ranking member of the Senate Banking Committee, to be able to get this bill to the floor. And they don't want to permit any amendments that are going to derail the legislation.
Todd, I'm also hearing that there's a lot in there about perhaps reducing the ability of credit card companies to market cards to college students on the theory that they generally can't afford to have credit options anyway.
Yes, that's true, and that's one of the provisions that is in both the House and the Senate version. There's a lot of concern that they have been marketing cards to people who can't afford them, quite frankly, or people who don't understand them, get in over their heads, and then ruin their credit for the next several years because they can't pay off the credit card debt. And so both bills, and presumably the eventual bill that goes to the president, will contain a provision or provisions that limit when cards can be sent to college students, requiring co-signers, people who can demonstrate an ability to make payments on the card, and things of that nature, because right now those limits don't exist. And as someone who received a credit card when he was in college, I can see how dangerous it can be.
We won't ask a lot of probing questions about that. That sounds like you're still in therapy. But
fortunately, it did not ruin my credit, but that's a lot of responsibility to have that card. And both bills would require that either a parent or guardian be a co-signer or be willing to demonstrate that they would be the backstop in the event that the cardholder was unable to pay.
Well, I got about 2 minutes left, Todd. Tell me, so they get credit card off the table presumably this week or next week based on the timeline you're talking about. Give me a quick preview of what's on the summer agenda in the world of financial services in Congress.
Well, I think the first and biggest ticket item on financial services is going to be undertaking financial regulatory reform. The President and the House and the Senate, actually, Senator Dardenne and Chairman Frank, have all talked about the need to revamp the financial services regulatory system in the United States to bring it up to date, to bring it current. And one of the buzz terms in that discussion is systemic risk regulator. That will be one of the biggest challenges that Congress face in trying to figure out how to go about making the system more responsive to how the economy actually works now. And whether it's going to be the Fed, the FDIC, the SEC, some combination of all the above, Treasury, that's what has to be worked out, and I think that's what they will turn to immediately coming back from the Memorial Day recess.
Fantastic. Well, folks, we have been joined by one of our good friends and frequent contributors, Todd Cranford from Patton Boggs. If you've got questions for Todd, you can email him at tcranford, that's T-C-R-A-N-F as in Frank, O-R-D, at pattonboggs.com. We're going to be back in just a minute with some discussion of who the next Supreme Court justice is going to be. Keep it locked here on Capital Thinking on the Voice America Network.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Parents, did you know that high school dropouts make 42% less than graduates? Someone will have to make up that difference, and chances are, that will be you. That means paying 42% of their groceries.
Ooh, more candy.
42% of their dentist bills.
No more candy.
Even 42% of their therapy sessions.
It's all my dad's fault.
Save your money. Encourage your kids to stay in school. For help and advice, call 877-FORAKID. A message from the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having
having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to Capital Thinking. It's time for one of the favorite guessing games in Washington, D.C., and that is let's talk about who's going to be the next Supreme Court justice. Our guest this segment is Nick Allard. He is the co-chairman of the Public Policy Department at the law firm of Patton Boggs here in Washington, D.C., and a participant on this show on a regular basis. Nick, welcome back. How are you today?
I'm terrific. It is, you know, it is that season where we have the truly Washington game, guessing game and procrastinating game. It's I'm finding that just, I guess, because I'm old enough, I know an awful lot of these people. And,
well, before we talk about who's on deck, let's kind of close the chapter on David Souter. Tell us a little bit about what you think the justice's legacy will be and how that might impact the president's decision making this time around.
Well, a pure jurist and a big brain on legs. Certainly, the president has big Birkenstocks to fill in picking somebody to step in and replace Souter. He's been, you know, the conservatives like to use the word activist when, in reality, from you know, often it's there's as many activist conservatives as liberals. But certainly, David Souter addressed each case on its own bottom and sort of reasoned his way out in terms of where he should end up. So he was, in many ways, very unpredictable. And the classic example of how presidents can never fully anticipate how a jurist will be and perform once they're on the Supreme Court. It's a classic example. Because he was appointed by a Republican, as you know.
Yeah, he turned out to be a stealth candidate like George Bush the Elder wanted, just not a stealth candidate for the Republicans. Well, listen, so you made the comment earlier that you personally know a lot of these folks, and I believe some of them might have been law school classmates, so I want to work through the short list, but I also want to ask, how could any of these people be appointed and confirmed if they know you, Nick?
Well, they'll have to overcome that huge hurdle, but notwithstanding that, and by the way, I've had the privilege of meeting and knowing a little bit Justice Souter, and he's a very remarkable man. It's an honor to know him. He's going back to his native state that he loves. He really never became someone a part of Washington, which is kind of interesting. And
almost unique. Almost everyone ends up going native, and he didn't.
Did not go native, no. In fact, he never unpacked for his apartment. He figured that he'd be, you know, 19 years ago, he figured that he might be returning to New Hampshire soon, so he never bothered to unpack or hang his pictures, feeling, what's the use? I'll just have to repack, and he told me that, and maybe he's told that story fairly widely, but so he's returning, and it's just going to be a little easier for him because all he has to do is put the boxes back into his car.
Yeah.
So there's a short list now that's been circulating for the last, you know, day or two. The president met with Senate leaders, congressional leaders, and you know, at the head of that list is about six or seven people. Is Judge Sonia Sotomayor of the Federal Court of Appeals in New York, and Judge Diane Wood of the Federal Court of Appeals in Chicago, the new Solicitor General, the former Harvard Law School Dean, Elena Kagan. There's two people that aren't particularly scholarly by reputation, but they have you know, strong political and legal credentials. Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm and the current Department of Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano, who was the state attorney general and the governor of Arizona. There's one male judge on the short list at this moment, Judge Merrick Garland of the Federal Court of Appeals. There's actually two, Merrick Garland, Federal Court of Appeals Court in Washington, D.C. He's a very able, thoughtful man. And then Carlos Marino's name is on the list, and he's with the California Supreme Court Justice. So procrastinating, I think that you can pretty much, if it was me personally and if I was a betting man, I'd put my whole bundle on Sonia Sotomayor. And, she has to be considered the front runner for a lot of reasons. And also, I just have a personal bias, having worked in the dining halls as an undergraduate with her and then also being in law school with her and followed her career with great interest. She's been a terrific, strong jurist, a district trial court, somebody that some folks might recall. She's a great baseball fan of the New York Yankees, that are in her native Bronx, New York, and she actually was the judge that broke up the last baseball strike. So she's very...
She lost her some votes in New England, with all those Massachusetts and New England Democrats that are bound to be Red Sox fans, Nick. You may have just cost her confirmation by revealing she's a Yankees fan.
Well, the only vote that counts for her right now is a White Sox fan, and he's in the White House.
That's true enough. Well,
but you can just work through the list backwards and to see why, you know, she is by far the front runner, and there doesn't appear to be any mind that bird in the field. So, you know, I think a surprise would be highly unlikely. You never know. But to start with, I think there's virtually no chance that either of the male judges will be named. The president is just unlikely to leave one woman on the court. There's been some pressure on him from the Latino community, and he hasn't, you know, made as many high-level Latino appointments. And so, you know, not only being a terrific jurist, but on the diversity score, she rates very high, Sonia Sotomayor. Elena Kagan has just recently been appointed as Solicitor General. We can remember there's going to be one or two more openings available, so this may not be her time. Janet Napolitano, who the president is very impressed with, he also needs at this moment. She's working very hard at a critical point, and he's just announced that in addition to everything else he's trying to do, immigration reform and the whole issue of border security with Mexico in its current distress are two front-burner issues, and he really needs Janet Napolitano right where she is as the Secretary of Homeland Security. So, you know, if you sort of work backwards that way, you have to think that Sonia Sotomayor is the presumptive favorite. Judge Diane Wood, of course, comes from Chicago.
On the faculty with President Obama at Chicago Law School?
Exactly right. So, you know, because of that and because of the strong Chicago connection, you know, I would put her as a strong, second place contender, but certainly somebody very, very able who the president would be very comfortable with. She's more of a business transactional type legal scholar. And bear in mind that there will be other opportunities in the not-too-distant future in all probability for this president.
Well, you mentioned, the strong likelihood that it's going to be a woman, and certainly a lot of interest groups that help put President Obama in the White House would be very interested in that. And a couple of these candidates are Hispanics. If you go by what most the media thinks, there's never been a Hispanic justice. Some argue that Cardozo was, in fact, the first Hispanic-American justice on the Supreme Court, but obviously the first in a long while, even if you want that argument. What about the African-American community? Are they not pressing to have a successor to Thurgood Marshall, or are they sort of taking a wait-and-see attitude, knowing that other vacancies will occur?
Well, I'm sure they're very interested in having the composition of the court being one where their agenda, their issues are addressed. Their comfort level is increased tremendously by having the first African-American president in the White House. And I'm expecting there to be a lot of support for a diversity candidate from that community. One of the interesting things to see is going to be how the Republicans in the Senate react and treat this nomination. There's every indication that they're not going to give an easy pass to whoever it is that the president nominates. And the dynamic and what's at stake is very, very high. All of these candidates are terrific jurists. They've already been vetted, so to speak, all of them having gone through either confirmation hearings or been in the public eye. They all have a very clean record. And so the only arguments out there will be, you know, on ideological grounds, whether some of Judge Sotomayor's rulings have been too liberal and so on, and whether litmus tests are applied, or whether Judge Wood ruled in favor of pro-choice, you know, interests in some of her decisions, you know, these kinds of things. Also, you know, the Republicans may find it in their interest to take up, eat up as much time as possible in the Senate and on the Senate floor, because that may make it more difficult and may enable them to run the clock a bit this year on the other major agenda items that are rolling down upon them that the president will be pushing. So there's a lot of moving parts here, but I don't expect the Republicans to sit back and give an easy pass to the nominee.
That's a great strategic point, that essentially every day spent on nomination on the floor is a day that you're not fighting a bill on health care reform.
Health care, regulation of tobacco, you know, energy reform, climate change, immigration reform, on and on and on. And,
yeah,
you know, this administration refuses to proceed linearly. They're doing it all at once, sort of converged all the issues. And so the Republicans may see this as a crucial way, like Horatio at the bridge, to sort of, you know, head off the larger army of issues as before it gets across the bridge.
Well, Nick, we got about 90 seconds left. Give me sort of your thumbnail sketch of a timeline for when we'll hear the president make a decision and when we'll start to see the confirmation hearings and floor consideration.
Monday will be
Monday.
The announcement is my guess. Being that definitive means I'll, by definition I'll be wrong. But I think the president has publicly stated that he intends to review the list and the credentials and discuss with his staff this weekend, and there's some pressure. He also knows that timing is key, so he wants to get this over with. And then they'll be, you know, scheduled for hearings as soon as possible. Senator Leahy will move as quickly as he can. And again, these are people on the list that we just went over who have already, you know, been vetted, and so the additional vetting and information that needs to be pursued can be short-circuited a bit. The Republicans will want to be taking as much time as possible. I'd say confirmation hearing before the 4th of July recess, and then, you know, Senate vote after that.
Well, Nick, we may want to get you scheduled.
I can't believe how specific
Thursday
I am. I'll be proven wrong on every point for sure.
You know, because the battle, there'll be a lot of strategic thinking on the battle ahead once the decision is made. We're going to have to take a commercial break here. We've been joined by Nick Allard from Patton Boggs. If you're interested in talking with Nick about this issue or others, you can reach him at nallard, N as in Nancy, A-L-L-A-R-D, at pattonboggs.com. We're going to come back in just a minute with the ambassador from Sri Lanka. You're listening to the Voice America Network.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Marhaba.
From Denver
Hello.
To Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to Capital Thinking. We seem to be having some technical difficulties. I am hoping that eventually in this show we will be joined by the ambassador from Sri Lanka to talk a little bit about some interesting developments down there. If you follow international news closely, you know that there is a battle raging between the government of Sri Lanka and a committed band of rebels, terrorists called the Tamil Tigers, who are basically holding hostage tens of thousands of citizens in a small area of that country, and the government is trying to work with the rest of the world to get in and get those hostages out and also end the terror that they're facing in their own homeland. And as I mentioned, we hope to have the ambassador on the show some point this afternoon. He seems to be running a little bit late, so we're going to head over and talk about a couple other topics of what's going on in Washington this week. We got some fascinating things on the agenda here. We had Nick Allard just now talking a little bit about what is going on with the Supreme Court nomination process. I think I actually agree with Nick. I think we're going to see a really quick timeline. I wouldn't be surprised if the president does announce on Monday. Many of you know the president was out in Arizona yesterday making a commencement speech at Arizona State University. I bet that when he got on Air Force One yesterday, he had a lot of briefing books and a lot of quality time to spend with his top advisors talking about who was going to be the next Supreme Court nominee, and I wouldn't be surprised if he makes a decision here in the over the weekend. Again, as Nick said, all those people have been vetted, and we will, means they can have a little quicker confirmation process. And I think he knows that with 60 votes, being on the verge of 60 votes in the Senate, he doesn't have to worry as much about the Republicans coming out in strong opposition to his nominee. It's going to have to be a very carefully orchestrated campaign to oppose almost anyone that the president would put forth for the position here. So that's interesting, and the House and Senate are sort of getting ready to put the wraps on their May agenda. They are going to be in today, and then they go home for the weekend. They'll be back next week, probably fairly busy week. Their focus will largely be on passing the Supplemental Appropriations Bill to fund the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think they'll get that done by the end of next week. And then as Todd Cranford was mentioning earlier in the show, I think we're going to see some time spent on finalizing this credit card legislation and giving the Obama administration a significant win that they can take to consumers and say that they've made some very positive changes to the legal landscape and helped consumers deal with one of their biggest challenges in a time of financial need for many households across the United States. And one of the reasons they're moving so quickly is congressmen and senators, they know they're going to be home all Memorial Day week. They're going to be at the parade in small town America. They're going to be at some very public events. And they want to be able to talk about tangible achievements that are recent, that their folks are just saying, gosh, what have you been doing in Washington the last month? They want to come home and say, well, look, I accomplished X, Y, and Z in the last 30 days for you, and that's often why you see some of the biggest pieces of legislation passed just before folks go home like they're going to do next week. But after May, I know most of our savvy listeners out there know it's tremendously expensive, tremendously busy time period and in the last several months, and we're looking at an even busier summer. And I just want to kind of gird you for that situation. We've got a summer here on tap that could have a convergence of major, major legislation. We've got that Supreme Court nomination. That's going to tie up a lot of time this summer, and I think Nick's sort of insight is a really valuable one that a lot of people haven't sort of picked up on yet, and that is that Republicans will try and slow walk the nomination on the floor, maybe not in the confirmation hearings. They're going to put up procedural roadblocks, because if they can waste valuable Senate time, not waste it, that's not the right term, if they can spend valuable Senate time talking about this nomination, even if they know they can't block it, that's slowing consideration of every other major policy request that the president has. And I think that's a tactical procedural win for the United States Senate if you're a Republican. So anyway, that's interesting. Then the other big issues we're going to spend much of the summer talking about, huge issues on the president's agenda, climate change and health care. The president and House Democrats announced a big decision yesterday that they're going to try and get health care reform done by the end of July. And that's a huge lift in the next legislative session of 6 or 7 weeks. You've got the House is going to take that week off on July 4th. They're going to be gone, so they're only going to be in for about 3 weeks and in June, and then they're going to have all of July before they go out for all of August. But they got to do that. There are, as of today, we don't have a bill to talk about. We don't even have principles that everybody in the majority in the House of Senate have sort of coalesced behind to draft legislation. In fact, if you look at the news carefully, what you see is a lot of Democrats negotiating amongst themselves in both the House and the Senate. In the House, you've had a very visible effort by the so-called Blue Dog Democratic Coalition. These are the most conservative 50 or so House Democrats. Typically, most of them are from districts that are Republican-leaning, places that voted for John McCain or certainly voted for George W. Bush in the recent presidential elections, maybe strongly Republican-leaning at state level. And, they have to watch their backs all the time. And what that group was pushing against is making sure that health care reform makes sense fiscally, which is a huge issue when you talk about the astronomical numbers that are involved in health care reform and paying for it all, paying to cover. There's a reason 47 million Americans aren't covered under any insurance plan, and that's because it's expensive to do so. And in order to cover them, the rest of us are going to have to reach into our own pocket to make that happen in one way or another. And then Blue Dog Democrats are very concerned about that, and they are a big enough bloc that if they stand together, they can make a difference in the negotiations of what's in that package for health care reform. On the Senate side, you see a similar group of centrist Democrats who are trying to get some of their principles. They're less formally organized as a group on the Senate side than the Blue Dogs are on the House side, but you still see Democrats there trying to work together, the moderate Democrats, to carve out their own path that avoids some of the landmines they think await them politically and policy-wise on some of these large healthcare issues. And what is an example of that? Well, probably the biggest example of that, besides what the cost is and how we pay for all of these grand plans for reform, is whether or not there's a public option provided for to cover folks. And by public option, we mean whether or not the federal government would essentially sponsor a health care plan that would be available to people who are uncovered that they could take, and that public plan would be competing with a plan offered from a private insurer. A lot of folks, you talk about the progressive and liberal wing of the House and the Senate, those folks have getting a public plan option as their driving force for health care reform. They believe that the best way to have a better system is to have the federal government centrally involved and being the provider. They do see that, many of them, as a step to towards a single-payer system where everyone eventually is involved in paying just the federal government, and they have oversight and control of all the health care options. Now, that, of course, is what a lot of folks oppose in Congress, both certainly Republicans large-scale, but also some of the blue dogs oppose the idea of a public option with him. So the issue is whether or not that public option is on the table here as Democrats sort of negotiate amongst themselves. The Blue Dog Democrats, again, they sent out some signals this week that indicated they were willing to talk about public option, but they want to have a seat at the table, and they want to consider themselves politically in play before they'll concede on something like that. Republicans, some health care providers, a lot of people in the industry are worried that a public health option, health plan option, basically, even if it doesn't do away with private insurance today, it creates a clear road path to doing away with it, in that you encourage companies to start dropping their own private insurance coverage so that people will join, will be forced to join the government system, and you also create a large-scale entry. They'll argue that you can't possibly have a government-run entity that Congress and the administration don't go out of their way to favor on a regulatory basis to encourage people to join the public plan at the expense of joining a private plan, so that sooner or later, eventually, you've driven all of the profitability out of the system and the providers drop out, or the companies force their folks to go on the public plan, and you get to a single-payer system that way. So there's a lot of concern about that. That's going to be a huge battle this summer in the next 60 days if the president's timeline is to be believed. Other big issue is cap and trade and this climate change legislation. The House had been hoping to mark up some legislation by Memorial Day. And that obviously is not going to happen. It's similar with the health care. The biggest challenge right now is the Democratic Party negotiating amongst its various factions to figure out a bill that everyone can coalesce behind. And the issue is not progressive versus moderate as much as it is where you live has a lot to do with where you stand on this issue. If you're a Democrat from an oil patch state, obviously a Texas, a Louisiana, a couple other places, or you're from a coal intensive state, think West Virginia, Virginia, Ohio, your very natural resources are a big part, and energy resources are a big part of your state's economy, you want to make sure that this cap and trade program doesn't put your industry out of business, doesn't put your producers out of business, doesn't unduly land on them in terms of charging them for the privilege of continuing to operate under this new cap-and-trade system. There are also some big battles brewing over what the renewable energy standards should be, how much electricity should be generated in the future from wind and solar, and hydro, things like nuclear continue to sort of be, for lack of a better word, radioactive. There are many Democrats who are coming around to the notion that perhaps having nuclear would be a good long-term strategy, but that's a place where the Democrats are, again, having challenges. The environmental lobby, which has a big voice in the new majority in Congress, has very conflicted feelings about whether or not nuclear is the way to go. So I think that's a challenge for them as they go forward. We'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to Capital Thinking here on the Voice America Network.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street
to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Okay, welcome back to the show. Well, I promised you earlier we would have the ambassador from Sri Lanka. He has joined us now. Our guest is Ambassador Jalaya Wickramasura from Sri Lanka. He's the ambassador here to the United States. Let me, Ambassador, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you for inviting me for the show.
Well, great. Well, let me tell people a little bit about Sri Lanka before we jump into things. For folks who don't know about it, we're talking about an island nation of 20 million people off the coast, southeast coast of India. If you remember recent history, they got hit by a tsunami in December 2004 that did a lot of damage. But the damage that's going on in the country now is coming from ethnic violence by a gang of terrorists called the Tamil Tigers. This is one of the most ruthless terrorist organizations. These folks may have actually been the people who invented suicide bombing in the 20th century, and if you remember your history, they assassinated former Indian Prime Minister Gandhi, and they've also assassinated a president and foreign minister in the country of Sri Lanka. Now, the United States and others have outlawed the Tamil Tigers, and the government of Sri Lanka's got a battle on their hands with these guys. They're basically holding about 20,000 civilians in a corner of Sri Lanka right now. And there's a little bit of a standoff. So, Ambassador, tell us a little bit about what's going on the ground in Sri Lanka right now.
Right now, this terrorist group is cornered to, as you mentioned, to a very small area in Sri Lanka. It's less than 1.5 square miles. And our main problem is this terrorist group is keeping a minimum of 20,000 civilians as human shield. So government is trying to get the civilians out without hurting any of them. So it's a difficult task. So we are going defensive and trying to rescue them.
I see. Very good. Well, tell us, you know, I see a lot of media coverage of this issue right now, and a lot of it seems to be aimed at you and your country without perhaps understanding the facts on the ground. I see you know, calls for a ceasefire, and tell us a little bit about why we don't just have a ceasefire and a negotiated peace settlement at this point.
Yes. In Sri Lankan government, we have a democratically elected president, and it's a democratically elected government for the last so many years. So we had so many ceasefires and so many peace accords signed with these Tamil Tigers. They don't. We have very, very bad experience working with ceasefires with these Tigers. Every time we have agreed to a ceasefire in the past, the terrorists have manipulated it into for them to regroup, rearm, and reposition, and to buy weapons during that period. We have every intention of continuing our effort to eradicate terrorism from our country. So ceasefire never worked with them, and everybody who comes to talk about ceasefire and political solution and who involved with Sri Lankan government to solve these problems got killed, including, as you mentioned, Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi and our own Prime Minister, President of Sri Lanka, President Premadasa, and our Foreign Minister who was a Tamil, Lakshman Kadiragama, and so many political leaders got killed by these people. Since they were coming for a political solution.
Well, Mr. Ambassador, I think most Americans would understand. I certainly do. If you negotiate one peace settlement with the guys, a ceasefire, and they violate it, I would never give them another opportunity to violate that again. So I understand why you don't want to sit down and negotiate with folks whose word are no good and they're continuing to attack you all. Now, again, a lot of media coverage seems to be negatively slanted against the country's positions here. I understand you've got news organizations complaining that reporters can't get into the conflict area to report on what's going on. And, of course, if they were there, they'd no doubt be complaining that you're not doing an adequate job of protecting them from the terrorists that they came to report on. Are you all actively keeping reporters away from the fighting, or what's actually going on there?
The conflict zone is just 1.5 square miles area. Since January this year, we have allowed 112 journalists have been given access to the battlefront, not to the conflict area, because the area is completely mined and it's very, very dangerous. Booby traps, mines. So we have brought them up to where the army and the security forces are. And these organizations includes Reuters, London Telegraph, BBC, Al Jazeera, and number of Sri Lankan and Indian newspapers and television reporters. Thing is, we don't want to send them inside the conflict zone because this terrorist organization is the most ruthless terrorist organization, according to FBI. So we do not want to put anybody into the danger because even if they don't do purposely, there are so many mines there. We don't want anybody to, step into a mine and lose their life. So that is the government concern. But still, we have got 112 journalists since January taken into this area, to the border areas of the conflict zone.
I see. Well, let me ask you. I know that there are reports of a lot of people displaced by the fighting. My researchers here say 190,000 people are in welfare centers that are being run by your government, people who used to live in northern Sri Lanka and have been displaced by these terrorists. What's happening to those folks, and how can we help them?
Right now, we have given access for over 56 international AIDS organizations, including UNHCR and Red Cross, UN, and so many NGOs and INGOs are there. So they are helping us out with giving them food and shelter and whatever they need. So we are trying to make them life very much easier inside and comfortable as possible. And what our main idea is to return the civilians to their homes as soon as possible. But only concern is their safety before we send them back to their homes. Their areas are heavily mined, so we need to demine their villages. The LTT used many mines when it left villages. In the eastern province, we liberated from these tigers and we demined the area and we send the people back to their original homes within 8 months. So our main concern is the civilian, and we will, first of all, we demine the area and take out all the mines, and then with the help of the international community, we'll rebuild their houses, and we want to put these innocent civilians at their original homes as soon as possible.
Mr. Ambassador, I got time for just one more quick question, about 30 seconds left. Tell me, the President Obama has called just this week for a political solution to the problem. What are you doing with to work with the Obama administration and other international officials to bring a conclusion to this and restore peace to the land?
We should appreciate the President Obama's appeal and the warning to the terrorist organization to release these civilians whom they are keeping as human shields. I think that's a good statement he did. At the same time, we should be thankful to him for concerning about our country and concerning about our civilians. At the same time, the political, our president, Rajapaksa, has already invited all the Tamil political parties in Sri Lanka to come to a discussion and solve this Tamil's problem. In fact, we have already implemented this political solution in the eastern province after liberating from the Tamils, and there are Tamil ministers. We have 13 Tamil ministers in the national government, and we have Tamil chief minister in the eastern province. So we want to do the same thing in the northern province, and President has already invited these all Tamil parties, politicians, as well as moderate Tamil leaders to come and talk to him simultaneously. I think in the next couple of weeks' time, we are having a big meeting with all the important leaders.
Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much for joining us. We'd love to have you on another time to talk more in detail about the challenges your country faces. We're going to be back next week with more Capital Thinking. Until then, keep your radio locked here on the Voice America Network.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.